It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk about the life and legacy of poet Maya Angelou, who passed away earlier today.
First, we hear a lot of news these days about 3D printing, from prosthetic hands to 18th century paintings and furniture. New and cool stuff is being printed all the time.
And that got us wondering, just how exactly does this technology work, and what are the implications here for the future of manufacturing and industry and commerce? And is all of it maybe too good to be true?
To help shed some light on 3D printing, we've got Hod Lipson here with us. He's a professor of engineering at Cornell University and co-author of the book Fabricated, the New World of 3D Printing. Hod, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So when I think of printing, I think of my printer, the 2D kind. It shoots ink onto a piece of paper, no problem. 3D printing sounds a little more complicated. Can you give us an idea of how it works?
Well, it's actually not very much complicated. It's just like an inkjet printer prints a picture by spitting out droplets of ink onto a piece of paper. A 3D printer will spit out droplets of plastic and gradually build up a three-dimensional object layer by layer. So not a picture of a cup of coffee, but the coffee cup itself, something you can drink out of. So there's maybe 24 different technologies. They don't just work with plastic, but with metals and ceramics and many other materials. But they all build up objects by stacking up layer upon layer of material.
So it's just one really thin layer at the bottom and then the layer on top of it, and just keeps going?
That's right. And usually you can't even see the layers. It comes out to be a solid object. You can barely see the layers, and it might take a couple of hours depending on the size or the volume of the object. But in the end, you pluck it out of the machine and you have it.
And how complicated are the objects we can do with this? Is it just simple stuff like a cup, or can we get really, really detailed with it?
That's exactly one of the wonderful things about this technology, is that the printer itself doesn't care about the complexity of the object. So just like your inkjet printer doesn't care if you're printing a circle or you're printing the Mona Lisa. It will just go ahead and print the picture. It won't take longer to print a complex picture than a simple geometric shape. Same thing with the printer. In general, it doesn't care about the complexity of the part. It can be a complex perforated organic shape, or it can be a cube. It doesn't matter.
And the complicated side, I would guess, is on the programming end of it. How difficult it is to tell my 3D printer what I want printed.
So that's one of the challenges right now. I think this technology is a fantastic manufacturing technology, and it exceeds what we can design today. There's a big gap today between what we can manufacture with this technology and what we can design. So most people, you know, when I ask my students to design a pencil holder or some kind of shape, some kind of part, usually they find it very difficult to design organic shapes or things that are very complex because of limitations of software today.
What are some of the most exciting uses you're seeing this put to recently?
So I think there's a whole range of application, and if you sort of search for this topic, you'll find numerous new ideas that people come up with every day. So some of these are sort of in the more industrial side, where you have aerospace companies using these technologies to make better, lighter components for aircrafts, things that perform better and use less fuel and things like that. So we're seeing more and more of that affecting the industry. But then you have things like fashion and even more esoteric applications like food printing and bioprinting.
Food printing. What is that?
That's right. So, you know, when we first released our open source printer back in 2005, the Fab at Home, out of Cornell, what happened is that people started building these printers at home, and they didn't print aircraft parts, they didn't print robots, they printed parts out of chocolate, out of cookie dough, and so forth. So at the time, it was a sort of a novelty thing, but since then it's grown, and I think this whole area of food printing might be the killer app.
How is this going to change business and manufacturing?
So, you know, often people ask me, At what point does 3D printing break even with conventional mass production, with injection molding? And I think that's the wrong question to ask. The real innovators take this technology and take advantage of the fact that it can make things that are very complex, can make customized and optimized parts, and use that to create objects or create business models that are not wouldn't be economically viable before. And there's lots of examples of these kinds of things, but it's really about really sort of pushing the envelope of how we customize and optimize parts.
So if I wanted to do an assembly line or a mass manufacturing thing, it's easiest if I do the same thing again and again. If I had a 3D printer, I could do almost the same thing and again, but with a slight variation each time, and it didn't cost me anything extra to set it up, right?
Exactly. We call it variety is free. So when you look at sort of the disruptive elements of the technology, complexity is free, as I mentioned earlier, and also variety is free. So the machine doesn't care if it's printing 50 times the same part or 50 different parts. So, for example, if you were printing orthodontic aligners that need to be different every time, customized for every person, that's not a problem. You could just go ahead and do that. So a lot of business models, you're printing eyeglasses, if you're printing shoes, you don't have to make the same thing over and over again. You can start customizing and optimizing it for each user, for each application.
We've got a caller on the line. Steve in Appleton has some experience with this. Steve, hi.
Good afternoon. How are you doing today?
Good. What did you want to tell us about 3D printing?
Well, I just wanted to talk a little bit about it. I'm with the Appleton Makerspace up in Appleton, Wisconsin.
Oh.
And a lot of people come to our place to just get access to some of these 3D printing technologies. It's a, you know, great hobbyist thing, too. A lot of people are building their own.
Steve, thank you so much for bringing that up. And Had, I had wanted to ask you, Makerspaces seem like they've been pioneers in introducing this technology to a lot of people.
Right. I think so the technology itself has been around for 30 years. But what has happened over the last decade or so is that technology has also come down in cost and become accessible. And today you can find it in makerspaces around the world, really. Not just 3D printing, but laser cutting and all these digital fabrication technologies. And we're seeing sort of a renaissance of making, this idea that anybody could design something and make something. And it's a fantastic thing. It accelerates innovation. It's good for education. You see a lot of energy around making and manufacturing in general coming back.
I read a lot of science fiction, and there are a lot of scenarios, maybe not in the too distant future, where I could see somebody in an isolated place, not access to buy stuff, wanting this if you're on the Enterprise or the Serenity or maybe a Mars colony, a 3D printer to replace whatever parts break. Is NASA or other space-type people looking at this?
NASA is definitely looking at this. There's been quite a lot of work on trying to print in space, understand what that means, printing spare parts on the space station, also trying to print with sand on the moon, not on the moon itself, but with moon sand-like material to see if we can one day print on the moon or Mars with in-situ materials. But, you know, when I look back onto the science fiction movies, let's say Star Trek, you always think about the replicator, but it always sort of frustrated me that the Star Trek replicator users only printed things they already had. They never innovated with that machine.
Yeah.
Always the same thing. And but really, the power of this technology is not about replicating things that you already have that you've made some other way, but it's really about creating new things you cannot create any other way, and that's really the promise.
Had, thank you so much for sharing this with us today.
My pleasure.
That was Had Lipson, professor of engineering at Cornell University. He's co-author of Fabricated, The New World of 3D Printing.
We take some time this afternoon to remember the life and legacy of Maya Angelou, who passed away this morning at the age of 86.
Angelou will be remembered as many things, a poet, storyteller, activist, autobiographer. One of her most famous poems was Still I Rise, originally written in 1978. Here's a bit of her reading the end of that poem.
Out of the huts of history's shame, I rise. Up from a past rooted in pain, I rise. A black ocean leaping and wide, welling and swelling, I bear in the tide. Leaving behind nights of terror and fear, I rise. Into a daybreak miraculously clear, I rise. Bringing the gifts that my ancestors gave. I am the hope and the dream of the slave. And so, naturally, there I go rising.
Maya Angelou reading from her poem, I Rise. And those words still resonate with us today, more than 35 years later. Here to talk with us about what Angelou meant to the world and to share her memories is Madison-based poet and author Fabu, who also served as Madison's poet laureate from 2008 to 2011. Fabu, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, it's my pleasure to be able to just add my testimony to the wonderful life of Maya Angelou.
Well, Fabu, I know this is a sad day for you and for people around the world. How did she, though, as a poet, inspire you? What went through your head when you learned that she was gone?
I felt a great sadness that another elder had left the earth. And there's always the thought in my mind, who could ever take her place? So the thing about Maya Angelou, she was just the consummate artist because she was a poet, she was a writer, but also a dancer, a composer, an activist. She wrote cookbooks. And so just like another one of her famous poems, she was really a phenomenal woman.
And that poem we just heard, I know that poem. I haven't heard it in a while, but there is something about her voice that it just sort of gives you goosebumps. I guess for me, I'd say you can hear in her voice that she has walked the walk. This is a woman who has lived these experiences and come out the other side. What do you think strikes you about just the way she presents her thoughts and her poetry?
Well, at first, when you always heard Maya Angelou's voice, you could identify it immediately, just as you said, for the richness and the weight of her voice, and you could hear seasons in it. I mean, in her voice is her absolute perseverance as a woman and also her refusal to be ashamed of any aspect of her life. So she's a great role model, not only as a writer, but as a human being. And that poem, Still I Rise, talks about the human experience in terms of whatever happens to you, still rise up.
Is that part of the message of Maya Angelou's life and work, that message of hope and optimism and to just keep getting up no matter what happens?
It is, but it was also a voice that was real in that she talked about her sadness, her tragedies, her failures. I think that Maya is so important to literature in America, and especially African-American, because she was so absolutely honest in her creativity, but in her telling her story of her life, especially in her autobiographies. And I just finished reading her last one, Mom and Me and Mom, that she wrote just a few years ago. So from the beginning, from the famous I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, to her talking about her relationship with her mother, she really is so inspiring because it means that whatever lives the rest of us live, we can also approach it with the same undaunting courage. And I'll be honest, as a poet, I'm not sure I would lay out every nook and cranny of my life, but Maya Angelou did it with a great deal of grace and love and acceptance of other people.
And you just referenced what is probably her most famous work, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, and it's the retelling of her life and girlhood in the South in the Jim Crow era. What would you say is particularly striking about that piece of work?
Well, it was, again, taking the experience that most African Americans had lived in the South but had never read about, you know, had never seen someone tell the story, which was essentially their story as well. I was always struck with her talking about her grandmother, who was being disrespected by a little white girl. And Maya said in there, you know, her grandmother said, nothing's going to make me, nothing and nobody's going to make me not get to heaven. I'm going to live my life in a way that I can be proud of. And I remember reading that as a very young person myself, and it really helped me to interpret experiences that no matter what happens to you, you have a choice about how you let it affect you.
So was that a touchstone for you with Maya Angelou's work, that you would go through something in your own life and you would stop and think, you know, how did Maya process this and how can I do something to walk in her footsteps?
Well, I have to tell you that I consider Maya Angelou the people's poet. For example, her poem, Phenomenal Woman. As I was growing up, I cannot tell you how many times I heard that poem in the community. In fact, I can't help but smile now because I had a cousin who did it for a reading at a community event. And I can still hear her saying, I'm a woman, phenomenal woman, that's me. So she was a great influence, really, on everyday people in the United States who could grasp hold to the beauty and the joy in which she lived her life. Because, again, phenomenal woman, I just think for the hope and joy and sassiness that her poetry infused into everyday life, well, that was a wonderful gift.
I want to take a caller now that we've got on the line. Pam is with us now from Kellogg, Minnesota. Hi, Pam.
Hello. You know, I've been gone all day, and I just heard about Maya, and it's very sad. I didn't even know who she was until Oprah introduced her, as I didn't know who Kenny G was, and now I love both of them. She wrote her cookbook, and her stories were so wonderful, with a story with every recipe, And the phenomenal woman, when I heard her read that, I don't think anyone could read it with the feeling that she did. And very sad that she's gone. She had a lot to teach us, as you said. Very great person.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Pam, for sharing your thoughts. And here's another person, Pam, who's been touched by the phenomenal woman. And it sounds as though, you know, even later in life, maybe especially later in life, she really had a broad audience of people who were introduced to her work through Oprah. She was on TV a lot. She was a public speaker. She was a friend of the Obamas, I gather, as well. She really did go out into the world, and her influence is palpable out there, isn't it?
Well, she also did tours. So she came to Madison some years ago. I was able to see her in person. I was one of the judges for a poetry contest for young poets, and it was a beautiful evening full of Maya Angelou, but also the fact that it was connected to young and upcoming poets, and it was such a memorable evening.
Now, we were talking a bit about Why the Caged Bird Sings, her early work about her girlhood. And one of the things that I didn't know, which was incredibly striking to me, is that apparently until she made her mark with that piece of work, there were literary critics out there who said that the lives of African-American women weren't worthy of memoir, and she proved them wrong with that. So that's a huge watershed moment for literature and for African-American women.
Yes, she showed that our stories were just as riveting and fascinating as anyone else's in the human family, but also the way the books were written. It was just real Maya all the way through. It was as if you were sitting down and she was in your living room and she's telling you her story. So she was able to translate her great storytelling ability into her memoir.
Had you ever met her personally?
I actually did when she came to Madison, Wisconsin.
And what was that like?
Well, she was just as full. I guess to meet Maya Angelou, first of all, you have read her books and, you know, have an idea of the fullness and wonder of her life and her vast experiences on several continents, meeting some of the great leaders like the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. And there she stands, a very tall and striking woman with this, again, unforgettable voice. It was a great moment, and she was gracious and kind. But I also have a funny story to tell you because...
And I'm going to have to hit pause on that. We want to hear this story so much, but we have to go to news. So hold on just a moment, Fabu. We're talking with Madison poet Fabu about the life and legacy of Maya Angelou, who died today at the age of 86. We're going to hear that story coming up, and we'd love to have you join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'd love to know what Angelou's work meant to you. Did you have a favorite work of hers that you find yourself coming back to? And what sort of legacy does she leave behind? You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking now with Madison-based poet Fabu about the life and legacy of Maya Angelou. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. And we'd love to hear what Maya Angelou meant to you. Were you inspired by her work? And what emotions are you feeling today if she meant something to you? Do you have poems or pieces of her writing that you come back to in your life, maybe as you go through different things and you get some inspiration there? 800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll go to our phone lines right now. We've got Joan joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Joan.
Hi. Well, I just turned the radio on, and this is the first that I heard that she died today. And I feel horrible and have such wonderful memories. I went to University of Wisconsin Eau Claire to hear her speak when my daughter, who's now 48 years old, was a freshman at Eau Claire. And she really didn't want to go with me because she didn't know who Maya Angelou was. And I kind of made her. And she has thanked me so many times. and I've read so much of her work. And I just... Well, she had a wonderful life, and she influenced so many people and did such great things that we have to be thankful for her full life and thankful for what she's left behind.
That's beautifully put, Joan. Thank you so much. And Joan got to see Maya Angelou speak, and you actually got to meet her, Fabu. And before we went to our news, we were going to hear a story. You had a funny story about meeting her.
I do. I have a really good friend, and she also, just like your last listener, met her at an occasion, and she said there had been a long line to get autographs, and she didn't make it in time to get one, and then she saw Miss Maya walking away, and so she started running after her, and she kept hollering her name, Maya, Maya, Maya. So she stopped, turned around, reached out her hand to greet her and to take her paper and sign it, and she said, "Now you know you're not supposed to be calling me Maya." And, of course, me and my friend just laughed because we're both African-American, both from the South, and understand the respect system. Now, here's this internationally known artist, and for sure people call her Maya Angelou around the world. But she recognized a young Southern girl and knew that there were other things that were in play. So what other people don't know about Maya Angelou is that she knew several languages, that whenever she traveled to a country to work, she believed in learning the language of the people there.
And she lived in Egypt and Ghana.
Yes, yes. She also met Nelson Mandela in 1962, even before he was imprisoned. And yet she lived such a long life that she wrote in his memory a wonderful poem called His Day Is Done. And I can't help but think, today marks the fact that Maya's day is done on this earth, but her poetry and her influence continues on.
Hmm. I want to take another caller now. Let's talk to Lynn, who joins us now in Eau Claire. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Veronica. It was the first thing I heard this morning, and being a woman of just about 60, my elders, the women who inspired me, who paved the way for me, are passing on. And it's hard to wrap your head around. She will leave a big hole in so many lives. She was everyone's mother, sister, friend. We're blessed for her being here.
Oh, thank you so much for those thoughts. I love the way you put that. She was everyone's mother and sister and friend. And she does have that feeling. You know, I've never met her. I've only come as close as her recordings. And I heard her interviewed by Kathleen Dunn on Wisconsin Public Radio. But she did have that quality. You felt like she just sort of wrapped you up in her warmth and her words. And she had wisdom. You talked about her being an elder. And Fabu, you talked about that earlier, too, that she's one of these elders that paved the way for the younger generation of women. How does that factor into the loss today?
Well, it makes us look at ourselves and see that, you know, to take stock. So what we've benefited from, what we've had, the opportunity to learn from them, to understand from them, to have imparted into us, it asks the question, what now will we do with our lives? How will we continue her legacy? You know, when an elder goes, then it's the next generation that's supposed to step up. So it definitely becomes, to me, more of a challenge to be the kind of person that we see leaving the world. And we can say that about so many people. I just referenced Nelson Mandela and the fact that Maya wrote a very beautiful poem about him. When the great ones leave us, it leaves us stunned and saddened, but also I believe that it challenges us to continue their legacy.
Well, thank you so much for that call, Lynn. And it's made me want to hear her voice again. So let's listen to another piece of Maya's voice reading, "I'm a Rainbow in Somebody's Cloud." This is from 2012.
You need to ask, what's all the selling and the yelling, the beating and the cheating all about? Take time out. Oh, you can sell your soul for money, then run off to the country for your cookouts and your parties on the lawns. While our children seek sedation in Eastern meditation or visions that go shooting up their arms. When you know that youth is dying on the run and my daughter trades dope stories with your son, we better ask, what's all the bleeding and the kneading, the killing and the thrilling all about? We better take time out and accept the fact that I am a rainbow in somebody's cloud.
Maya Angelou there reading, "I'm a Rainbow in Somebody's Cloud." Fabu, what does that poem mean to you?
Well, again, she is speaking to contemporary times, because a lot of what we've talked about are really famous pieces, the ones that we all know from a couple of decades. So I really enjoyed listening to that piece because it speaks to the here and the now. It speaks to the youth and what is happening with them, and asks the rest of us to wake up and be concerned and care about our young ones.
As a poet, does her loss mean something special to you? She was obviously much more than just a poet that you looked up to, but is there something there in particular that you think you'll miss?
Well, I really appreciate all the sentiments of your listeners today, because, again, when I heard, and I heard through the request for this interview, I simply cried. I just lowered my head and wept. And I think that's probably the greatest testimony to the influence of her poetry, on a human level. And then, of course, I do feel it deeply because of her mastery with words and because I, too, am a wordsmith. So it's just a time to weep and then to wipe our tears and celebrate her very long and full life. And the thing about, to me, one of the most wonderful things about being a poet, Maya Angelou will continue to be rediscovered or discovered again and again in future generations.
We're going to miss her.
Yes, we are, deeply and profoundly.
It's a hard loss, but I think, like you said, the fact that she left a gift for us, she left so much behind, it's something to console ourselves.
It certainly is.
Well, Fabu, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was an honor to speak about the life and the words of Maya Angelou.
We've been talking to Fabu, a poet and author based here in Madison. She served as the city's poet laureate from 2008 to 2011. We've been talking about the life and legacy of Maya Angelou, and we'll leave this segment right now by reading the last tweet that Angelou sent out to her followers, which has since been retweeted over 55,000 times. That was a couple hours ago. That tweet said, "Listen to yourself, and in that quietude, you might hear the voice of God." Chances are you've come across our next guest work in the movies, Toy Story, Epic, or A Bug's Life. William Joyce writes and illustrates children's books and films, and he's known for his book, The Mischievians and Meet the Robinsons, and has a new offering out called Numberlies. William, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Well, I want to start off by listening to a little bit of your work. This is the movie that came from your book, The Leafman.
Uh-huh.
Where are we?
It's where this guy lives.
Most stompers just come and go, but this guy's relentless.
Wait, stompers?
Yeah. You know, like us, but big and dumb and slow, always stomping on things.
He's my dad. I'm a stomper.
What happened? You got shrunk?
Yes!
Seriously?
It's been a weird day for everybody.
Clip there from the movie Epic. And I want to ask you, you've been called a guardian of childhood. As a children's author and illustrator, what does that mean to you?
Well, I did a series called The Guardians of Childhood where I sort of defined all the, or tried to define through intense personal investigation, the origins of Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy and Jack Frost and the Easter Bunny and the Man in the Moon and all those guys. I interviewed them, went to their lands, and transcribed their stories. And so the Guardian's Oath that they that was at first initiated by the Man in the Moon and the other guardians take says something like, "We will watch over the children of Earth to keep happy their hearts and brave their souls and rosy their cheeks. And we will guard with our lives the children of Earth because they are all that we have, all that we are, and all that we will ever be." And so that's sort of my mantra, I guess. I do my books and my stories and movies and stuff to sort of keep the spirit of childhood alive and that sense of optimism and adventure and possibility.
I love that concept of writing and illustrating with protecting the kids' terrain, I guess, in mind. But how do you put that into practice? How are you mindful of that as you're creating?
You know, it's like I've absorbed so much of the things that I loved from popular culture since I was a kid. And I've always gravitated towards the things that had a sort of, I don't know, buoyant, adventurous spirit. And, you know, Frank Capra movies, The Wizard of Oz, Errol Flynn's Robin Hood, the Little Rascals, The Three Stooges. I mean, all these things that I grew up with, that they have a certain Antarctic spirit to them. But they're also, you know, sweet-spirited in a way. I mean, even though the Three Stooges hit each other over the head all the time with anvils, they are good pals. You sense that. And so, I don't know, growing up with that stuff just sort of imprinted itself on my DNA. And so it's always seems to be the kind of story I tend to tell.
It's interesting that you use the word anarchic. It strikes me, you know, something similar with Maurice Sendak and Where the Wild Things Are, that there is a sort of wild boundary of childhood that you know, still speaks to adults, obviously, but there's something about childhood that, you know, really likes to get out there and be wild. Do you feel that in your work?
Yeah, I do. And in fact, Wild Things was probably the single catalyst that put me on this path. I was 5 years old, and I just found out I'd seen King Kong, and my parents had to explain to me that King Kong wasn't true. And I'm like, no, it was true. It was on TV. It was the news. I saw it. It was awesome. But I'm really sad they killed Kong. He was a really great guy. He was just the wrong size. They're like, no, it's a made-up thing. And I'm like, well, I don't understand this made-up. What do you mean? I'm like, well, it's this thing called fiction. And I go, well, who makes fiction? And I said, grown-ups do. And I was like, oh, those guys. I can't trust them. And so later that week, though, I was like, just had this empty sense of, like, gosh, if there's not, you know, King Kong, then everything else was in doubt, you know? But I sat down, and in our library was this new book called Where the Wild Things Are. And I looked at those pictures, and I read that story, and I knew at that moment that this is what I wanted to do. I was like, who did this? Who did these drawings? And the librarian said, "It's the name on the book is the guy who's called the author. And then there's another person that draws the pictures. They're the illustrator. But this one... this guy did both. He made up the story and it drew the pictures, and his name's Maurice Sendak." And I go, "And he's a grown up?" And they go, "Yes." And I go, "And this is what his job is?" And they're like, "Yes." And I'm like, "Well, that's what I want to do." And so when my first book was published in 1988, it was with Harper and Row, they were called then, and it was also the 25th anniversary of the publication of Where the Wild Things Are. And I asked my editor at Harper & Row if I could somehow meet Maurice, because Harper & Row had published Where the Wild Things Are. And so my first signing in New York City, right when I was finished, the guy at the bookstore, Books of Wonder, which is still there, wonderful bookstore in New York, Peter Glassman, the owner, came up to me and said, "You have a phone call, and you're going to want to take this." I pick up the phone and I hello. He goes, "This is Bill Joyce." Yes. "This is Maurice Sendak." And I was just like dumbfounded. And he said, I understand you want to meet me." And I go, Yes, sir. I very much would like to." And he said, "Well, why?" And I go, "Well, And he goes, "Okay, when you were a little boy?" And I go, "Yeah, when I was a little boy, I read Where the Wild Things Are. And if you hadn't done that book, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now."
Wow, what a great story.
Goes, "All right, meet me at the Empire State Building in 30 minutes. And so, yeah, we struck up a friendship, and he was a good sort of mentor to me from then on. So I've kept my wild rumpus going and through Maurice, and was very sad when he passed.
Well, you're a grown-up, and your name is on another book now, The Numberlees. Can you give us a taste of that project?
Well, okay. It's another example of me watching a movie and getting influenced and putting it in a book. For ages, I've wanted to do an alphabet book, but I couldn't think of an interesting way to do that. And I was like, you know, I love the alphabet. I love language. I love just shapes of the alphabet. They're just so pleasing. But, you know, I didn't want to just do A is for apple, B is for boy. And so I've been, like, aching for some epic way to make an alphabet book. And that was rotating around in my head for a while. And then I went to see Metropolis when it was restored a couple of years ago. They found all this missing footage, and it was finally put back together in its original form. And the first time it had been seen in the way the director, Fritz Lang, had wanted people to see it since it premiered in 1927. And it just blew me away. It was such a magnificent, gigantic, epic film. And it's influenced so many science fiction films since then. And I had my kids with me, and they were just blown away. And I'm like, all right, if kids can respond to this 1927 futuristic epic, then they can – a picture book can – I can introduce them to the idea of that kind of grandeur.
And that led you to The Numberlees. That's all the time we have. Thanks to William Joyce. His new book is The Numberlees.